I'm delighted to welcome Dr. Jonathan Green to the panel. He's a professor of child and adolescent psychiatry at the University of Manchester, an honorary consultant psychiatrist at the Royal Manchester Children's Hospital. He's trained in pediatrics in London and psychiatry in Oxford and has a long-standing clinical and research interest in autism and other aspects of social development. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Green.
Good morning. Thank you so much to Sally for inviting me on behalf of my team to present in this symposium after an inspiring plenary talk that she gave this morning saying what could be possible with intervention. My subject is mechanism and developmental science, which really leads off from some of what Sally was talking about. And I'm going to be arguing in this talk we are entering, I believe, into the possibilities of a new phase of intervention science in autism, building on, as Sally was initially hinting at, some of the emerging developmental science. And a really, what I'm going to be advocating here is a true translational intervention science. We want interventions that emerge from developmental science, and also we want trial designs that not only help us discover good treatments, but also help us understand development better. So it's an iterative cycle, is what I'm proposing. And there are various theorists who've talked about how we can design trials in this way. So George Howe, in the 2002 important paper, talked about the so-called hybrid trial, which is a lot of actually what in developmental science we're able to undertake if we design it well, which is the combination of a randomized ascertainment to parallel groups with repeated measures developmental designs. And the combination of those two allows us to look at causal relationships in development in a really outstanding way that's quite difficult in simple association developmental studies. The other sort of background foundation theory I'm going to build on in my talk is from Helena Kramer. Other people have made similar points. But really it's this, that only by really understanding mechanism within our trials and within our treatment designs are we going to be able to empirically then move our treatments forward. And she advocates this iterative cycle where we identify active ingredients or mechanism from our treatments, and then we use those in the next phase of the treatment to then take the next step into a more effectiveness. And what this implies for treatments is that they are going to be constantly on the go. If we're going to be modifying our treatments as we go along according to our findings, we're going to have to be flexible, we're going to have to give up stuff as well as take on new stuff, and we're going to need to morph interventions and transform them. And this is part of what I'm going to be advocating here if we're really going to take the next steps into changing children's development through intervention science. And partly there's a philosophical difference here between trials that are really set up to investigate developmental science and mechanism from those that are essentially set up to prove that treatments work. And although, of course, as interventionists, we're interested in both things because we're all invested in the treatment styles that we work with, this investigative stance, which is more empirically driven, is, I'm going to argue, what we're going to need. And there are good examples from other areas of health science where sequences of iterative trials collaboratively done across different centres have had transforming effects in outcomes. And a famous example, the sequence of trials for childhood leukemia in the 1970s and 80s that transformed the prognosis for childhood leukemia from a mean survival time of 6 months to what it is now, which is 80% cure. And this was done over a couple of generations through this iterative cycle that funders funded, which is another message I'm going to be arguing for in the talk. So with that background, I'm going to be talking about two different aspects of my group's recent work. The first is targeting biomarkers in the prodrome, so in the in the first few months in the year of infant development in autism. And the second, which I'll come on to after that, is how we can look at mechanism in the way I've described in our in one of our preschool treatments. So those two aspects I'm going to be talking to you about to illustrate some of these opportunities for intervention science. So firstly, let's look at this targeting biomarkers in the prodrome. This is a study that we published just earlier this year, and this is the reference for it in Lancet Psychiatry, so you can have a look at it in detail if you're interested. It's a big study with lots of collaborations, as you can see, and funders. And this study built on our emerging understanding of risk biomarkers within infant SIV studies. And I'm sure most of you in the audience will be familiar with these studies in the States and in the UK, and this is the UK version of it. And we've discovered through these studies a number of what we could call risk biomarkers for later autism in the first year of life. And again, many of you will be familiar with this kind of work. Neural sensitivity to eye gaze. This interesting phenomenon of attentional flexibility reducing in the latter part of the first year, predicting later autism. Work that we've particularly done on perturbations in parent-infant interaction in the latter part of the first year that predict later autism. We'll be saying more about that. And the emerging, as it were, one could call pre-symptom behavior at around a year, which again is predictive of later autism. These are subtle signs of atypical behaviors that we start to see. So a number of studies have started producing these risk markers that are associated with later autism emergence in these high-risk studies. There is a lot of question about how these markers might interact together. Are they additive? Are they multiplicative in their action? What's our theory about how these things develop? And Sally again was talking about some of the notional theory behind this, but a lot of this hasn't really been empirically studied in a way that we can really unpick what's going on. So our study I'm going to describe here is a prodromal intervention in the first year between 9 and 14 months that addresses these developmental concerns. And it's focused on the perturbation that we found in the parent-infant interaction. So that is what the style of work that Sally was talking about and other models have done similar things to look at how we can modify parent-infant interaction to enrich social experience early on. That's where this intervention was focused. And our proximal outcomes, the things that we were really targeting, were these risk biomarkers. So we're setting up an experiment based on the developmental science to see if we can shift these risk biomarkers, with the implication, of course, that if we could shift those, we might be able to alter downstream trajectories. We are not thinking we're going to cure or prevent autism emerging. I want to make that clear in this. What we're doing here is altering risk trajectories, and so we don't know what we'll find when we look downstream, but it may be that we can mitigate some risk severity, and we can certainly learn a lot about development in the process. So the intervention is a social communication intervention, parent-mediated, using video feedback. It's 12 sessions over 5 months, so it's home-based with parental practice, home-based practice in between the sessions. And this is a model that's familiar to a number of different kinds of styles of social communication intervention from different groups. And what we conducted here, I'm going to tell you about, is a two-site, two-arm RCT, testing this intervention against what was, in effect, no intervention, because these are babies, there isn't a regular intervention for them. 54 children, infants took part, in parent-infant dyads took part in this RCT, and it had good internal validity. So I'm just going to highlight some of the main results that we published a few months ago for you to have a sense of, and I want to just use them. I won't have time to go in detail into the results that are indeed, we think, very fascinating and intriguing, but I want to use them as an illustrative of how we can develop these kind of trial models. So the first few variables at the top of the diagram here are basically our interaction variables. And if I point to these two, the infant attentiveness to the parent within the dyad and the parental behavior in relation to the infant, these were our two proximal outcomes. The infant attention was our primary, which we pre-specified. And you'll see we've been successful in this treatment, certainly at changing the parental behavior towards the infant. We know we're very good at doing that. Parents are very responsive to this kind of input. And we have a what we call a point estimate of an effect of about 0.3 on the infant attentiveness. So there's a signal of a shift with the intervention between these treatment as opposed to the non-treated group. You'll see the confidence interval is wide, and I'm going to come back to this issue about the precision of our estimates in a early study like this. But what struck us was the pattern of the response to the intervention was across different domains. So here is the attention disengagement. And this is an interesting variable because, as I suggested to you, the risk biomarker aspect of it is that in these infants who are going to go on to develop autism, their attention gets less flexible in the latter part of the first year, what we could call sticky attention. And what we suggest here in this result is that we've actually reversed that and we've normalized their attentional flexibility using this intervention. And then the AOC, which is a measure of pre-symptom behaviors, atypical behaviors, at a year of age at the end point of this trial, we've also shown a signal of effect that we've reduced the atypicality of behaviors. There was also an unexpected finding that has to do with auditory sensitivity, which seemed to go in the other direction. And this also related to an apparent slowing in early language, which was a very intriguing result. And it just goes to show you don't always get results in the way that you expect. We actually think this may be artifactual, but it's going to need to be replicated, and we're going to need to look downstream to be sure about what this actually means. And here are some of the language scores, and you'll see the VABS socialization is strongly positive at the bottom. But there is this apparent disaggregation of language and social development in the intervention, which is very intriguing if it stands up to replication. So this is the first RCT that's addressed an intervention into early biomarker development of this kind. As I say, we are looking at ameliorating risk here. The sample size is 54, so it's not tiny by any means, but it's smallish in relation to the task of really working out stable and substantive treatment effects. And the precision of our estimates can't be as big as it needs to be with a larger trial, so I'm going to come on to that. But what we think we've shown at least is signals that a social enrichment seems to impact these risk biomarkers, and this is a highly important result if it stands up. It seems to enrich them across social and non-social domains, across behavior and brain function, so cross-domain effects, and we've got this unexpected effect in auditory sensitivity. We're just doing the follow-up at 2 and 3 years, the analysis at 2, and then we're going to be doing the 3-year follow-up later. And so we won't really be able to know the true effect of development on development of this intervention for another year or so, and what we can learn from it from a developmental theory about the prodrome. We're also going to need to replicate this, and this is going to be true of any study that's really going to get solid findings in this area. We think we're going to need at least 200 participants. And this is one of my messages from this presentation, is that if we're going to take the next step in intervention science in autism, we have to up our game considerably in terms of our sample sizes and the robustness of our methods. It does also imply there are possibilities of other kinds of approaches to managing the affecting the biomarkers, more direct learning teaching approaches. So that's our work in the prodrome, just published. Now I'm going to tell you about mechanism work. This really builds on the sort of thing that Paul was talking about earlier, in how we can look at mechanism and try and evolve treatment as a result of looking at mechanism. So this builds on our PACT preschool autism communication trial, which we published quite a few years ago now in The Lancet. And you'll see the reference there if you're interested to look it up. And this, again, similarly to the infancy intervention, is a parent-mediated, so we work through the parents, the way Sally was describing, using video feedback, so it's a very precise process, using them as co-therapists, as adjunctive workers with us to impact on the child. And, of course, the great advantage of this is that if we can make this change in the parent-child interaction, it can carry through. I'm so sorry, can carry through into 24-7. Mustn't wave my hands around so much. Can carry through into 24-7 experience of the child. So here are the results of the PACT intervention. And these are published, as I say, this is the 2010 paper. So we're very good, if you look at the left-hand column at... so we're very good at changing the parental behavior with the child, and we see that the child behavior with the parent is also impacted significantly with this intervention. But then when we go downstream to the ADOS, we get a symptom change, but it's much attenuated. And the confidence interval of that change can't make us certain that it's not a chance effect. And this is true across autism learning generally, that that generalization of skill acquisition across contexts is difficult. It's one of our main challenges in designing autism interventions. And so this is our challenge for the next phase. How can we improve this generalization piece from what is in some ways very effective intervention, in other ways it isn't doing as much as we want it to do. Here's the parent reports of change, which suggest that even though the parents aren't blinded to treatment arm in a study like this, they are reporting how their children are doing in everyday life, so these reports have ecological validity, so in that sense they're important reports for us to take into account, and they're suggesting that we are making a difference to the child's communication in everyday life. So here's our mediation analysis that we published last year, and I'll give you the reference to the paper at the end of the talk. And what we've really aimed to do here is to take a next step in trying to understand some more complex mediation processes in these complex interventions that we're all doing in autism. Simple mediation and traditional mediation analysis probably isn't good enough in this kind of setting. And what we have tried to do here is to look at two other kinds of ways of approaching mediation and mechanism. One is using so-called instrumental variables, which I'm not going to talk more about because they didn't really work for us, and it's difficult to identify instrumental variables in studies like this, actually. The other was to fit what's called a latent mediator model. So this is using the fact that we've got these repeated measures, as I mentioned at the beginning, enables us to factor in, to deal with a lot of the measurement confound and the potential post-randomization confounds in mediators that are really significant problems technically in this area. And so using repeated measures, we are statisticians able to allow for this. And this is the mediation effects that we get using those techniques. So our effect on parental synchrony, which is our parental measure with the child, strongly mediates the increased child social communication with the parent. So this is important in the sense that it's showing that this is our hypothesized mechanism of treatment, and it's supported with this mediation model. So it's supportive of the theory. What's just as interesting is that the effect of the treatment on symptoms, so the downstream effect of our treatment on symptoms, is mediated strongly, just as strongly, by this impact, this increase in child initiation in the dyad. So what we're suggesting here is, or what the data is showing us, is that the increase that the child is able to make in dyadic interaction with the parent is the thing that is mediating the change in their interaction with the researcher in the ADOS exam. In other words, we are showing here generalization of skill acquisition, actually. It's just attenuated. But the mediation study shows us very clearly what is actually going on in the process of change. And we're able to test whether there are other non-specific parental effects that are impacting here, and what we find in the analysis is there aren't really substantially those, so that this is a very specific effect that we're generating. And the implications of this are on developmental theory, firstly, because it gives us, as I was suggesting earlier, this sense of a causal relationship. We're able to say pretty confidently from this kind of data that indeed increasing parental synchrony does affect child communication. That is a causal relationship, which hasn't in other developmental association studies, it's difficult to suggest that. So Michael Siller and Marin Sigmund's work on linking early synchrony with later communication outcomes couldn't actually prove the causal link, but we are kind of supporting their longitudinal research with this. And we're suggesting, and again, as Sally was suggesting in her talk this morning, that in this degree, children with autism are following normal developmental rules. It also has an impact on how we evaluate the dynamics of treatment change. So what we're suggesting here is that because we've got this mediation effect, that the movement in ADOS symptoms, although they were attenuated, we think they're meaningful in direction. And this gives us some confidence that we can build on this to push forward. And so what we're going to learn from this and develop, and this is using the Helena Kramer model of building on from the mechanism of one study into the design of the next one, is that our next study in this area is going to be trying to booster this generalization in a systematic way so that we know exactly what we're doing. So in the top diagram, this is what we saw, what I've sort of described in the PACT model of mediation through the treatment mediating autism symptoms through the parent. That's fine. And the child. And what we're doing in the bottom right here is trying to booster this generalization piece down this chain of effect by working more intensively in the home and also in education, and building a mediation model for both home and education effects that will, we believe, improve the symptom outcome for the child and help their generalization through working in both areas. Now, it's, of course, the case that other people have worked in home and school before, but what I think we're able to do here is do it in a systematic way so that we'll be able to do a mediation study. We've designed that in. So that we'll be able to see exactly how this is working and learn from this about the processes for the children. So just my final reflections from this work. Autism intervention is a stiff challenge. We shouldn't underestimate this. Despite the inspiring vision we can have about what's possible, this is not an easy problem to really move to shift, and I believe we've only really begun to make a start at what's possible here. I've shown in this talk that we've been able to do something in the prodrome on early risk biomarkers, and in the diagnosed condition, the preschool, looking at mechanism analysis. For the future, I'm going to suggest that we need to have an emphasis in the autism intervention community on more collaborative work using shared measures, using common process designs, and a collaborative combination of effective ingredients. And this is the way, for instance, that the leukemia trials worked internationally in the 70s and 80s to produce their remarkable overall change. we maybe need to think more about effective components of interventions than about interventions as a whole, so what some people have called sort of brands of intervention. We all have our the intervention work we do, and we're going to need to do that with our own particular areas of work. But understanding these mechanism, effective ingredients things should help us combine effective ingredients from different kinds of interventions to do a better effect for the children downstream. And in order to do this, we're going to have more rigorous research designs. Because what the experience in other areas of intervention science and health has shown us is that unless we do have rigorous standards, actually we get misled and we won't learn from our what we do not so well as what we do well. So it's a plea for us to improve our standards of reporting and design so that we can study these mechanism effects as we go into our next round of treatment work in the field. So I'd like to thank you for listening, and our families, funders, and the teams who noted there. And these are the papers that I based the talk on, so they're all published, so you can have a look at those as we go forward. Thank you, Sally.
Thank you.